Oh, not even full. Even Lysa should know that's an invitation to a broken neck.
The mules know the way, Sir Brighton.
A wiry girl of 17 or 18 years stepped up beside Lord Nestor. Her dark hair was cropped short and straight around her head, and she wore riding leathers and a light shirt of silvered ringmail. She bowed to Catelyn more gracefully than her lord.
"I promise you, my lady, no harm will come to you. It would be my honour to take you up. I've made this dark climb 100 times. Markle says my father must have been a goat."
She sounded so cocky that Catelyn had to smile. "Do you have a name, child?"
"Maya Stone, if it please you, my lady," the girl said.
It did not please her. It was an effort for Catelyn to keep the smile on her face. Stone was a bastard's name in the Vale, as snow was in the north, and flowers in High Garden. In each of the Seven Kingdoms, custom had fashioned a surname for children born with no names of their own. Catelyn had nothing against this girl, but suddenly she could not help but think of Ned's bastard on the wall, and the thought made her angry and guilty, both at once. She struggled to find words for reply. Lord Nestor filled the silence.
"Maya's a clever girl, and if she vows she will bring you safely to Lady Lysa, I believe her. She has not failed me yet."
"Then I put myself in your hands, Maya Stone," Catelyn said. "Lord Nestor, I charge you to keep a close guard on my prisoner."
"And I charge you to bring the prisoner a cup of wine and a nicely crisp capon before he dies of hunger," Lannister said. "A girl would be pleasant as well, but I suppose that's too much to ask of you."
The sellsword Bronn laughed aloud. Lord Nestor ignored the banter.
"As you say, my lady, so it will be done."
Only then did he look at the dwarf.
"See our lord of Lannister to a tower cell, and bring him meat and mead."
Catelyn took leave of her uncle and the others as Tyrion Lannister was led off, then followed the bastard girl through the castle. Two mules were waiting in the upper bailey, saddled and ready. Maya helped her mount one, while a guardsman in a sky-blue cloak opened the narrow postern gate. Beyond was dense forest of pine and spruce, and the mountain like a black wall. But the steps were there, chiseled deep into the rock, ascending into the sky.
"Some people find it easier if they close their eyes," Maya said as she led the mules through the gate into the dark wood. "When they get frightened or dizzy sometimes, they hold on to the mules too tight. They don't like that."
"I was born a Tully and wed to a Stark," Catelyn said. "I do not frighten easily. Do you plan to light a torch?" The steps were black as pitch. The girl made a face.
"Torches just blind you. On a clear night like this, the moon and the stars are enough. Michael says I have the eyes of the owl."
She mounted and urged her mule up the first step. Catelyn's animal followed of its own accord. "You mentioned Michael before," Catelyn said. The mule set the pace slow but steady. She was perfectly content with that.
"Michael's my love," Maya explained. "Michael Redfort, his squire to Sir Lynn Corbray. We're to wed as soon as it becomes a night, next year or the year after."
She sounded so like Sansa, so happy and innocent with her dreams. Catelyn smiled, but the smile was tinged with sadness. The Redforts were an old name in the Vale, she knew, with the blood of the first men in their veins. His love she might be, but no Redfort would ever wed a bastard. His family would arrange a more suitable match for him, to a Corbray or a Wainwood or a Royce, or perhaps a daughter of some greater house outside the Vale. If Michael Redford laid with this girl at all, it would be on the wrong side of the sheet. The ascent was easier than Catelyn had dared hope. The trees pressed close, leaning over the path to make a rustling green roof that shut out even the moon, so it seemed as though they were moving up a long black tunnel. But the mules were sure-footed and tireless, and Maya Stone did indeed seem blessed with night eyes. They plodded upward, winding their way back and forth across the face of the mountain as the steps twisted and turned. A thick layer of fallen needles carpeted the path, so the shoes of their mules made only the softest sound on the rock. The quiet soothed her, and the gentle rocking motion set Catelyn to swaying in her saddle. Before long, she was fighting sleep. Perhaps she did doze for a moment, for suddenly a massive iron-bound gate was looming before them. "Stone!" Meyer announced cheerily, dismounting. Iron spikes were set along the tops of formidable stone walls, and two fat round towers overtopped the keep. The gate swung open at Meyer's shout. Inside, the portly knight who commanded the Way Castle greeted Meyer by name, and offered them skewers of charred meat and onions still hot from the spit. Catelyn had not realized how hungry she was. She ate, standing in the yard, as stable hands moved their saddles to fresh mules. The hot juices ran down her chin and dripped onto her cloak, but she was too famished to care. Then it was up onto a new mule, and out again into the starlight. The second part of the ascent seemed even more treacherous to Catelyn. The trail was steeper, the steps more worn, and here and there littered with pebbles and broken stone. Meyer had to dismount a half-dozen times to move fallen rocks from their path. "You don't want your mule to break a leg up here," she said. Catelyn was forced to agree. She could feel the altitude more now. The trees were sparser up here, and the wind blew more vigorously, sharp gusts that tugged at her clothing and pushed her hair into her eyes. From time to time the steps doubled back on themselves, and she could see stone below them, and the gates of the moon farther down, its torches no brighter than candles. Snow was smaller than stone, a single fortified tower and a timber keep and stable hidden behind a low wall of unmortared rock. Yet it nestled against the giant's lance in such a way as to command the entire stone stair above the lower Way Castle. An enemy intent on the eyrie would have to fight his way from stone, step by step, while rocks and arrows rained down from snow above. The commander, an anxious young knight with a pockmarked face, offered bread and cheese and the chance to warm themselves before his fire, but Meyer declined. "We ought to keep going, my lady," she said, "if it please you." Catelyn nodded. Again they were given fresh mules. Hers was white. Meyer smiled when she saw him. "White is a good one, my lady, sure of foot even on ice. But you need to be careful. He'll kick if he doesn't like you." The white mule seemed to like Catelyn. There was no kicking, thank the gods. There was no ice either, and she was grateful for that as well. "My mother says that hundreds of years ago, this was where the snow began," Meyer said. "It was always white above here, and the ice never melted," she shrugged. "I can't remember ever seeing snow this far down the mountain, but maybe it was that way once, in the olden times." So young, Catelyn thought, trying to remember if she had ever been like that. The girl had lived half her life in summer, and that was all she knew. "Winter is coming, child," she wanted to tell her. The words were on her lips. She almost said them. Perhaps she was becoming a Stark at last. Above snow, the wind was a living thing howling around them like a wolf in the waste, then falling away to nothing as if to lure them into complacency. The stars seemed brighter up here, so close that she could almost touch them, and the horned moon was huge in the clear black sky. As they climbed, Catelyn found it was better to look up than down. The steps were cracked and broken, from centuries of freeze and thaw, and the tread of countless mules, and even in the dark the heights put her heart in her throat. When they came to a high saddle between two spires of rock, Meyer dismounted. "It's best to lead the mules over," she said. "The wind can be a little scary here, my lady." Catelyn climbed stiffly from the shadows and looked at the path ahead. 20 feet long and close to 3 feet wide, but with a precipitous drop on either side. She could hear the wind shrieking. Maya stepped lightly out, her mule following as calmly as if they were crossing a bailey. It was her turn. Yet no sooner had she taken her first step than fear caught Catelyn in its jaws. She could feel the emptiness, the vast black gulfs of air that yawned around her. She stopped, trembling, afraid to move. The wind screamed at her and wrenched at her cloak, trying to pull her over the edge. Catelyn edged her foot backward, the most timid of steps. But the mule was behind her, and she could not retreat. "I am going to die here," she thought. She could feel cold sweat trickling down her back. "Lady Stark," Maya called out across the gulf. The girl sounded 1,000 leagues away. "Are you well?" Catelyn Tully Stark swallowed what remained of her pride. "I cannot do this, child," she called out. "Yes, you can," the bastard girl said. "I know you can. Look how wide the path is."
"I don't want to look."
The world seemed to be spinning around her, mountain and sky and mules whirling like a child's top. Catelyn closed her eyes to steady her ragged breathing.
"I'll come back for you," Maya said. "Don't move, my lady."
Moving was about the last thing Catelyn was about to do. She listened to the skirling of the wind and the scuffling sound of leather on stone. Then Maya was there, taking her gently by the arm.
"Keep your eyes closed, if you like. Let go of the rope now. Whitey will take care of himself. Very good, my lady. I'll lead you over. It's easy, you'll see. Give me a step now. That's it. Move your foot. Just slide it forward, see? Now another. Easy. Oh, you could run across. Another one. Go on, yes."
And so, foot by foot, step by step, the bastard girl led Catelyn across, blind and trembling, while the white mule followed placidly behind them. The way castle called Sky was no more than a high, crescent-shaped wall of unmortared stone raised against the side of the mountain. But even the topless towers of Valyria could not have looked more beautiful to Catelyn Stark. Here, at last, the snow crown began. Sky's weathered stones were rimmed with frost, and long spears of ice hung from the slopes above. Dawn was breaking in the east as Maya Stone halloed for the guards, and the gates opened before them. Inside the walls, there was only a series of ramps and a great tumble of boulders and stones of all sizes. No doubt it would be the easiest thing in the world to begin an avalanche here. A mouth yawned in the rock face in front of them. "The stables and barracks are in there," Maya said. "The last part is inside the mountain. It can be a little dark, but at least you're out of the wind. This is as far as the mules can go. Past here, well, it's a sort of chimney, more like a stone ladder than proper steps. But it's not too bad. Another hour and we'll be there." Catelyn looked up. Directly overhead, pale in the dawn light, she could see the foundations of the eyrie. It could not be more than 600 feet above them. From below, it looked like a small white honeycomb. She remembered what her uncle had said of baskets and winches. "The Lannisters may have their pride," she told Maya, "but the Tullys are born with better sense. I have ridden all day, and the best part of a night. Tell them to lower a basket. I shall ride with the turnips." The sun was well over the mountains by the time Catelyn Stark finally reached the area. A stocky, silver-haired man in a sky-blue cloak and hammered moon and falcon breastplate helped her from the basket. Servadus Egan, captain of John Aaron's household guard. Beside him stood Maester Coleman, thin and nervous, with too little hair and too much neck.
"Lady Stark," Sir Varys said, "the pleasure is as great as it is unanticipated."
Maester Coleman bobbed his head in agreement.
"Indeed it is, my lady, indeed it is. I have sent word to your sister. She left orders to be awakened the instant you arrived."
"Well, I hope she had a good night's rest," Catelyn said with a certain bite in her tone that seemed to go unnoticed. The men escorted her from the winch room up a spiral stair. The Eyrie was a small castle by the standards of the great houses, seven slender white towers bunched as tightly as arrows in a quiver, on a shoulder of the great mountain. It had no need of stables, nor smithies, nor kennels, but Ned said its granary was as large as Winterfell's, and its towers could house 500 men. Yet it seemed strangely deserted to Catelyn, as she passed through it, its pale stone halls echoing and empty. Lysa was waiting alone in her solar, still clad in her bedrobes, her long auburn hair tumbled unbound across bare white shoulders and down her back. A maid stood behind her, brushing out the night's tangles. But when Catelyn entered, her sister rose to her feet, smiling. "Cat," she said, "oh, Cat, how good it is to see you, my sweet sister." She ran across the chamber and wrapped her sister in her arms. "How long it has been," Lysa murmured against her. "Oh, how very, very long." It had been 5 years, in truth. 5 cruel years for Lysa. They had taken their toll. Her sister was 2 years the younger, yet she looked older now. Shorter than Catelyn, Lysa had grown thick of body, pale and puffy of face. She had the blue eyes of the Tullys, but hers were pale and watery, never still. Her small mouth had turned petulant. As Catelyn held her, she remembered the slender, high-breasted girl who waited beside her that day in the Sept at River Run, how lovely and full of hope she had been. All that remained of her sister's beauty was a great fall of thick auburn hair that cascaded to her waist. "You look well," Catelyn lied, "but tired." Her sister broke the embrace. "Tired, yes, oh yes." She seemed to notice the others then, her maid, Maester Coleman, Sir Varys. "Leave us," she told them. "I wish to speak to my sister alone." She held Catelyn's hand as they withdrew, and dropped it the instant the door closed. Catelyn saw her face change. It was as if the sun had gone behind a cloud. "Have you taken leave of your senses?" Lysa snapped at her. "To bring him here? Without a word of permission? Without so much as a warning? To drag us into your quarrels with the Lannisters?" "My quarrels?" Catelyn could scarce believe what she was hearing. A great fire burned in the hearth, but there was no trace of warmth in Lysa's voice. "They were your quarrels first, sister. It was you who sent me that cursed letter, you who wrote that the Lannisters had murdered your husband. To warn you so you could stay away from them. I never meant to fight them. Gods, Cat, do you know what you've done?"
"Mother," a small voice said.
Lysa whirled, her heavy robe swirling around her. Robert Aaron, Lord of the Eyrie, stood in the doorway, clutching a ragged cloth doll and looking at them with large eyes. He was a painfully thin child, small for his age, and sickly all his days, and from time to time he trembled. The shaking sickness, the maesters called it.
"I heard voices."
Small wonder, Catelyn thought. Lysa had almost been shouting. Still, her sister looked daggers at her. "This is your Aunt Catelyn, baby. My sister, Lady Stark. Do you remember?" The boy glanced at her blankly.
"I think so," he said, blinking,
though he had been less than a year old the last time Catelyn had seen him. Lysa seated herself near the fire and said, "Come to Mother, my sweet one." She straightened his bedclothes and fussed with his fine brown hair. "Isn't he beautiful?" And strong, too. Don't you believe the things you hear? John knew. The seed is strong, he told me. His last words. He kept saying Robert's name, and he grabbed my arm so hard he left marks. Tell them, the seed is strong. His seed. He wanted everyone to know what a good, strong boy my baby was going to be. Lysa, Catelyn said, if you're right about the Lannisters, all the more reason we must act quickly. Wait, not in front of the baby, Lysa said. He has a delicate temper. Don't you, sweet one? The boy is lord of the area and defender of the Vale, Catelyn reminded her. And these are no times for delicacy. Ned thinks it may come to war. Quiet! Lysa snapped at her. You're scaring the boy. Little Robert took a quick peek over his shoulder at Catelyn and began to tremble. His doll fell to the rushes, and he pressed himself against his mother. Don't be afraid, my sweet baby, Lysa whispered. Mother's here. Nothing will hurt you. She opened her robe and drew out a pale, heavy breast, tipped with red. The boy grabbed for it eagerly, buried his face against her chest, and began to suck. Lysa stroked his hair. Catelyn was at a loss for words. John Aaron's son, she thought, incredulously. She remembered her own baby, 3-year-old Rickon, half the age of this boy and 5 times as fierce. Small wonder the Lords of the Vale were restive. For the first time she understood why the king had tried to take the child away from his mother to fuster with the Lannisters. We're safe here, Lysa was saying. Whether to her or to the boy, Catelyn was not sure. Don't be a fool, Catelyn said, her anger rising in her. No one is safe. If you think hiding here will make the Lannisters forget you, you are sadly mistaken. Lysa covered the boy's ear with her hand. Even if they could bring an army through the mountains and past the bloody gates, the area is impregnable. You saw for yourself. No enemy could ever reach us up here. Catelyn wanted to slap her. Uncle Brendan had tried to warn her, she realized. No castle is impregnable. This one is, Lysa insisted. Everyone says so. The only thing is, what am I to do with this imp you've brought me?
Is he a bad man?
The Lord of the Eyrie asked, his mother's breast popping from his mouth, the nipple wet and red. A very bad man, Lysa told him as she covered herself. But mother won't let him harm my little baby.
Make him fly,
Robert said eagerly. Lysa stroked her son's hair. Perhaps we will, she murmured. Perhaps that is just what we will do. Eddard. He found Littlefinger in the brothel's common room, chatting amiably with a tall, elegant woman who wore a feathered gown over skin as black as ink. By the hearth, Hewitt and a buxom wench were playing at forfeits. From the look of it, he lost his belt, his cloak, his mail shirt, and his right boot, so far, while the girl had been forced to unbutton her shift to the waist. Jorry Cassell stood beside a rain-streaked window with a wry smile on his face, watching Hewitt turn over tiles and, enjoying the view. Ned paused at the foot of the stair and pulled on his gloves. It's time we took our leave. My business here is done. Hewitt lurched to his feet, hurriedly gathering up his things. As you will, my lord, Jorry said. All out, we'll bring round the horses. He strode to the door. Littlefinger took his time saying his farewells. He kissed the black woman's hand, whispered some joke that made her laugh aloud, and sauntered over to Ned. Your business, he said lightly, or Robert's? They say the hand dreams the king's dreams, speaks the king's voice, and rules with the king's sword. Does that also mean you fuck with the king's... Lord Baelish, Ned interrupted. You presume too much. I am not ungrateful for your help. It might have taken us years to find this brothel without you. That does not mean I intend to endure your mockery, and I am no longer the king's hand. The direwolf must be a prickly beast, said Littlefinger with a sharp twist of his mouth. A warm rain was pelting down from a starless black sky as they walked to the stables. Ned drew up the hood of his cloak. Jorry brought out his horse. Young Will came right behind him, leading Littlefinger's mare with one hand, while the other fumbled with his belt and the lacings of his trousers. A barefoot whore leaned out of the stable door, giggling at him.
"Will we be going back to the castle now, my lord?"
Jorry asked. Ned nodded, and swung into the saddle. Littlefinger mounted up beside him. Jorry and the others followed. "Chatea runs a choice establishment," Littlefinger said as they rode. "I've half a mind to buy it. Brothels are a much sounder investment than ships I've found. Whores seldom sink, and when they are boarded by pirates, why, the pirates pay good coin like everyone else." Lord Petar chuckled at his own wit. Ned let him prattle on. After a time, he quieted, and they rode in silence. The streets of King's Landing were dark and deserted. The rain had driven everyone under their roofs. It beat down on Ned's head, warm as blood and relentless as old guilts. Fat drops of water ran down his face. "Robert would never keep to one bed," Lyanna had told him at Winterfell, on the night long ago, when their father had promised her hand to the young lord of Storm's End. "I hear he has gotten a child on some girl in the Vale." Ned had held the babe in his arms. He could scarcely deny her, nor would he lie to his sister. But he had assured her that what Robert did before their betrothal was of no matter, that he was a good man, and true, who would love her with all his heart. Lyanna had only smiled. "Love is sweet, dearest Ned, but it cannot change a man's nature." The girl had been so young. Ned had not dared to ask her age. No doubt she had been a virgin. The better brothels could always find a virgin if the purse was fat enough. She had light red hair with a powdering of freckles across the bridge of her nose, and when she slipped free a breast to give her nipple to the babe, he saw that her bosom was freckled as well. "I named her Barra," she said, as a child nurse. "She looks so like him. Does she not, my lord? She has his nose and his hair." "She does." Eddard Stark had touched the baby's fine dark hair. It flowed through his fingers like black silk. Robert's firstborn had had the same fine hair, he seemed to recall.
"Tell him that when you see him, my lord, as it please you. Tell him how beautiful she is."
"I will," Ned had promised her. That was his curse. Robert would swear on dying love and forget them before evenfall. But Ned Stark kept his vows. He thought of the promises he'd made Lyanna as she lay dying, and the price he'd paid to keep them.
"And tell him I've not been with no one else. I swear it, my lord, by the old gods and you. Shataya said I could have half a year for the baby and for hoping he'd come back. So you'll tell him I'm waiting, won't you? I don't want no jewels or nothing, just him. He was always good to me, truly."
"Good to you," Ned thought hollowly. "I will tell him, child, and I promise you, Barra shall not go wanting." She had smiled then, a smile so tremulous and sweet that it cut the heart out of him. Riding through the rainy night, Ned saw Jon Snow's face in front of him, so like the younger version of his own. If the gods frowned so on bastards, he thought dully, why did they fill men with such lusts? "Lord Baelish, what do you know of Robert's bastards?"
"Well, he has more than you, for a start."
"How many?" Littlefinger shrugged. Rivulets of moisture twisted down the back of his cloak.
"Does it matter? If you bed enough women, some will give you presents, and his grace has never been shy on that count. I know he's acknowledged that boy at Storm's End, the one he fathered the night Lord Stannis wed. He could hardly do otherwise. The mother was a Florent, niece to Lady Selyse, one of her bedmaids. Renly says that Robert carried the girl upstairs during the feast, and broke in the wedding bed while Stannis and his bride were still dancing.
Lord Stannis seemed to think that was a blot on the honour of his wife's house. So when the boy was born, he shipped him off to Renly. He gave Ned a sideways glance. I've also heard whispers that Robert got a pair of twins on a serving wench at Castle Rock 3 years ago when he went west for Lord Tywin's tourney. Cersei had the babes killed, and sold the mother to a passing slaver. Too much an affront to Lannister pride, that close to home. Ned Stark grimaced. Ugly tales like that were told of every great lord in the realm. He could believe it as Cersei Lannister readily enough, but would the king stand by and let it happen? The Robert he had known would not have, but the Robert he had known had never been so practiced at shutting his eyes to things he did not wish to see. Why would John Arryn take a sudden interest in the king's base-born children? The short man gave a sudden shrug. He was the king's hand. Doubtless, Robert asked him to see they were provided for. Ned was soaked through to the bone, and his soul had grown cold. It had to be more than that, or why kill him? Littlefinger shook the rein from his hair and laughed. Now I see. Lord Arryn learned that his grace had filled the bellies of some whores and fishwives, and for that he had to be silenced. Small wonder. Allow a man like that to live, and next he's likely to blurt out that the sun rises in the east. There was no answer Ned Stark could give to that but a frown. For the first time in years he found himself remembering Rhaegar Targaryen. He wondered if Rhaegar had frequented brothels. Somehow he thought not. The rain was falling harder now, stinging the eyes and drumming against the ground. Rivers of black water were running down the hill when Jory called out, "My lord!" His voice hoarse with alarm. And in an instant the street was full of soldiers. Ned glimpsed ringmail over leather, gauntlets and greaves, steel helms with golden lions on the crests. Their cloaks clung to their backs sudden with rain. He had no time to count, but there were 10 at least, a line of them, on foot, blocking the street, with long swords and iron-tipped spears. "Behind!" he heard Will cry, and when he turned his horse, there were more in back of them, cutting off their retreat. Jory's sword came singing from its scabbard. "Make way or die!" "The wolves are howling," their leader said. Ned could see rain running down his face. Such a small pack, though. Littlefinger walked his horse forward, step by careful step. "What is the meaning of this?" "This is the hand of the king." He was the hand of the king. The mud muffled the hooves of the blood-bay stallion. The lion parted before him. On a golden breastplate the Lion of Lannister roared its defiance. Now, if truth be told, I'm not sure what he is. "Lannister, this is madness," Littlefinger said. "Let us pass. We're expected back at the castle. What do you think you're doing?" "He knows what he's doing," Ned said calmly. Jaime Lannister smiled. "Quite true. I'm looking for my brother. You remember my brother, don't you, Lord Stark? He was with us at Winterfell. Fair-haired, mismatched eyes, sharp of tongue, a short man." "I remember him well," Ned replied. "It would seem he has met some trouble on the road. My lord father is quite vexed. You would not perchance have any notion of who might have wished my brother ill, would you? Your brother has been taken at my command to answer for his crimes," Ned Stark said. Littlefinger groaned in dismay. "Oh, my lords!" Sir Jaime ripped the longsword from his sheath and urged his stallion forward. "Show me your steel, Lord Eddard. I'll butcher you like Ares if I must. But I'd sooner you died with a blade in your hand." He gave Littlefinger a cool, contemptuous glance. "Lord Baelish, I'd leave here in some haste, if I did not care to get bloodstains on my costly clothing." Littlefinger did not need to be urged. "I will bring the city watch," he promised Ned. The Lannister line parted to let him through, and closed behind him.
Littlefinger put his heels to his mare and vanished around a corner. Ned's men had drawn their swords, but there were 3 against 20. Eyes watched from nearby windows and doors, but no one was about to intervene. His party was mounted, the Lannisters on foot, save for Jaime himself. A charge might win them free, but it seemed to Eddard Stark that they had a surer, safer tactic. "Kill me," he warned the Kingslayer, "and Catelyn will most certainly slay Tyrion." Jaime Lannister poked at Ned's chest with a gilded sword that had sipped the blood of the last of the Dragon Kings. Would she? The noble Catelyn Tully of Riverrun murder a hostage? I think not, he sighed. But I am not willing to chance my brother's life on a woman's honor. Jaime slid the golden sword into its sheath. So I suppose I'll let you run back to Robert to tell him how I frightened you. I wonder if he'll care. Jaime pushed his wet hair back with his fingers and wheeled his horse around. When he was beyond the line of swordsmen, he glanced back at his captain. Tregar, see that no harm comes to Lord Stark. As you say, my lord. Still, we wouldn't want him to leave here entirely unchastened, so... Through the night and the rain he glimpsed the white of Jaime's smile. Kill his men. No! Ned Stark screamed, clawing for his sword. Jaime was already cantering off down the street as he heard Will shout. Men closed from both sides. Ned rode one down, cutting at phantoms in red cloaks who gave way before him. Jorah Cassel put his heels into his mount and charged. A steel-shod hoof caught a Lannister guardsman in the face with a sickening crunch. A second man reeled away, and for an instant Jorah was free. Will cursed as they pulled him off his dying horse, sword slashing in the rain. Ned galloped to him, bringing his long sword down on Tregar's helm. The jolt of impact made him grit his teeth. Tregar stumbled to his knees, his lion crest sheared in half, blood running down his face. Hewitt was hacking at the hands that had seized his bridle, when a spear caught him in the belly. Suddenly Jorah was back among them, a red rain flying from his sword. No! Ned shouted. Jorah, away! Ned's horse slipped under him and came crashing down in the mud. There was a moment of blinding pain and the taste of blood in his mouth. He saw them cut the legs from Jorah's mount and drag him to the earth, swords rising and falling as they closed in around him. When Ned's horse lurched back to its feet, he tried to rise, but only to fall again, choking on his scream. He could see the splintered bone poking through his calf. It was the last thing he saw for a time. The rain came down, and down, and down. When he opened his eyes again, Lord Eddard Stark was alone with his dead. His horse moved closer, caught the rank smell of blood, and galloped away. Ned began to drag himself through the mud, gritting his teeth at the agony in his leg. It seemed to take years. Faces watched from candle-lit windows, and people began to emerge from alleys and doors, but no one moved to help. Littlefinger and the city watch found him there in the street, cradling Jorah Cassel's body in his arms. Somewhere the gold cloaks found a litter, but the trip back to the castle was a blur of agony, and Ned lost consciousness more than once. He remembered seeing the Red Keep looming ahead of him in the first grey light of dawn. The rain had darkened the pale pink stone of the massive walls to the colour of blood. Then Grand Maester Pycelle was looming over him, holding a cup, whispering, "Drink, my lord, here, the milk of the poppy, for your pain." He remembered swallowing, and Pycelle was telling someone to heat the wine to boiling and fetch him clean silk, and that was the last he knew. Daenerys. The horse gate of Aes Dothrak was made of 2 gigantic bronze stallions, rearing,
their hooves meeting 100 feet above the roadway to form a pointed arch. Danny could not have said why the city needed a gate when it had no walls and no buildings that she could see, yet there it stood, immense and beautiful, the great horses framing the distant purple mountain beyond. The bronze stallions threw long shadows across the waving grasses as Khal Drogo led the Khalasar under their hooves and down the guard's way, his blood riders beside him. Danny followed on her silver, escorted by Sir Jorah Mormont, and her brother Viserys mounted once more. After the day in the grass, when she had left him to walk back to the Khalasar, the Dothraki had laughingly called him Khal Rey Maar, the Sorefoot King. Khal Drogo had offered him a place in a cart the next day, and Viserys had accepted. In his stubborn ignorance, he had not even known he was being mocked. The carts were for eunuchs, cripples, women giving birth, the very young and the very old. That won him yet another name, Khal Ragat, the Cart King. Her brother had thought it was the Khal's way of apologizing for the wrong Danny had done him. She had begged Sir Jorah not to tell him the truth, lest he be shamed. The knight had replied that the king could well do with a bit of shame. Yet he had done as she bid. It had taken much pleading and all the pillow tricks Doria had taught her before Danny had been able to make Drogo relent and allow Viserys to rejoin them at the head of the column. "Where is the city?" she asked, as they passed underneath the bronze arch. There were no buildings to be seen, no people, only the grass and the road, lined with ancient monuments from all the lands the Dothraki had sacked over the centuries. "Ahead," Sir Jorah answered, "under the mountain." Beyond the horse gate, plundered guards and stolen heroes loomed on either side of them. The forgotten deities of dead cities brandished their broken thunderbolts at the sky as Danny rode her silver past their feet. Stone kings looked down on her from their thrones, their faces chipped and stained, even their names lost in the mists of time. Lithe young maidens danced on marble plinths draped only in flowers or poured air from shattered jars. Monsters stood in the grass beside the road, black iron dragons with jewels for eyes, roaring griffins, manticores with their barbed tails poised to strike, and other beasts she could not name. Some of the statues were so lovely they took her breath away, others so misshapen and terrible that Danny could scarcely bear to look at them. Those, Sir Jorah said, had likely come from the shadowlands beyond the Ashai. "So many," she said, as her silver stepped slowly onward, "and from so many lands." Viserys was less impressed. "The trash of dead cities," he sneered. He was careful to speak in the common tongue, which few Dothraki could understand. Yet even so, Danny found herself glancing back at the men in her cars to make sure he had not been overheard. He went on bitterly, "All these savages know how to do is steal things better men have built, and kill." He laughed. "Oh, they do know how to kill. Otherwise, I'd have no use for them at all." "They are my people now," Danny said. "You should not call them savages, brother." "The dragon speaks as he likes," Viserys said, in the common tongue. He glanced over his shoulder at Aego and Ricaro, riding behind them, and favoured them with a mocking smile. "See, the savages lack the wit to understand the speech of civilized men." A moss-eaten stone monolith loomed over the road, 50 feet tall. Viserys glanced at it with boredom in his eyes. "How long must we linger amongst these ruins before Drogo gives me my army? I grow tired of waiting." "The princess must be presented to the Dushkaleen." "At the Crones, yes," her brother interrupted. "And there's to be some mummer's show of a prophecy for the whelp in her belly, you tell me. What is that to me? I'm tired of eating horse meat, and I'm sick of the stink of these savages." He sniffed at the wide, floppy sleeves of his tunic, where it was his custom to keep a sachet. It could not have helped much. The tunic was filthy. All the silk and heavy wools that Viserys had worn out of Pentos were stained by hard travel and rotted from sweat.
Sir Jorah Mormont said, "The Western Market will have food more to your taste, Your Grace. The traders from the free cities come there to sell their wares. The Carl will honour his promise in his own time."
"He had better," Viserys said grimly. "I was promised a crown, and I mean to have it. The dragon is not mocked."
Spying an obscene likeness of a woman with six breasts and a ferret's head, he rode off to inspect it more closely. Danny was relieved, yet no less anxious. "I pray that my sun and stars will not keep him waiting too long," she told Sir Jorah, when her brother was out of earshot. The knight looked after Viserys doubtfully.
"Your brother should have bided his time in Pentos. There's no place for him in a Kalasar. Illyrio tried to warn him."
"He will go as soon as he has his 10,000. My lord husband promised a golden crown."
Sir Jorah grunted.
"Yes, Khaleesi, but the Dothraki look on these things differently than we do in the West. I have told him as much, as Illyria told him, but your brother does not listen. The horse lords are no traders. Viserys thinks he sold you, and now he wants his price. Yet Khal Drogo would say he had you as a gift. He will give Viserys a gift in return, yes, in his own time. You do not demand a gift. Not of a Carl. You do not demand anything of a Carl."
It's not right to make him wait. Danny did not know why she was defending her brother, yet she was. "Viserys says he could sweep the Seven Kingdoms with 10,000 Dothraki screamers." Sir Jorah snorted.
"Viserys could not sweep a stable with 10,000 brooms."
Danny could not pretend to surprise at the disdain in his tone. What if it were not Viserys, she asked? If it were someone else who led them, someone stronger, could the Dothraki truly conquer the Seven Kingdoms? Sir Jorah's face grew thoughtful as their horses trod together down the Godsway.
"When I first went into exile, I looked at the Dothraki and saw half-naked barbarians, as wild as their horses. If you'd asked me then, Princess, I should have told you that 1,000 good knights would have no trouble putting to flight 100 times as many Dothraki."
"But if I asked you now?"
"Now," the knight said, "I'm less certain. They're better riders than any knight, utterly fearless, and their bows outrange ours. In the Seven Kingdoms, most archers fight on foot, from behind a shield wall or a barricade of sharpened stakes. The Dothraki fire from horseback, charging or retreating, it makes no matter. They are full as deadly. And there are so many of them, my lady. Your lord husband alone counts 40,000 mounted warriors in his Kalasar."
"Is that truly so many?"
"Your brother Rhaegar brought as many men to the Trident," Sir Jorah admitted. "But of that number, no more than a tenth were knights. The rest were archers, free-riders, and foot soldiers armed with spears and pikes. When Rhaegar fell, many threw down their weapons and fled the field. How long do you imagine such a rabble would stand against a charge of 40,000 screamers howling for blood? How well would boiled leather jerkins and mail shirts protect them when the arrows fall like rain?"
"Not long," she said. "Not well." He nodded.
"Mind you, Princess, if the lords of the Seven Kingdoms have the wit the gods gave a goose, it will never come to that. The riders have no taste for siegecraft. I doubt they could take even the weakest castle in the Seven Kingdoms. But if Robert Baratheon were fool enough to give them battle..."
"Is he?" Danny asked. "A fool, I mean." Sir Jorah considered that for a moment.
"Robert should have been born Dothraki," he said at last. "Your Carl will tell you that only a coward hides behind stone walls instead of facing his enemy with a blade in hand. The usurper would agree. He's a strong man, brave, and rash enough to meet a Dothraki horde in the open field. But the men around him, well, their pipers play a different tune. His brother Stannis, Lord Tywin Lannister, Eddard Stark, he spat. "You hate this Lord Stark?" Danny said. "He took from me all that I loved, for the sake of a few lice-ridden poachers and his precious honour," Ser Jorah said bitterly. From his tone, she could tell the lust still pained him. He changed the subject quickly. "There," he announced, pointing, "Vaes Dothrak, the city of the Horse Lords." Khal Drogo and his blood riders led them through the great bazaar of the Western Market, down the broad ways beyond. Danny followed, close on her silver, staring at the strangeness about her. Vaes Dothrak was at once the largest city and the smallest that she had ever known. She thought it must be 10 times as large as Pentos, a vastness without walls or limits. Its broad, wind-swept streets, paved in grass and mud and carpeted with wild flowers. In the free cities of the West, towers and manses and hovels and bridges and shops and halls all crowded in on one another. But Vaes Dothrak sprawled languorously, baking in the warm sun, ancient, arrogant, and empty. Even the buildings were so queer to her eyes. She saw carved stone pavilions, manses of woven grass as large as castles, rickety wooden towers, stepped pyramids faced with marble, log halls open to the sky. In place of walls, some palaces were surrounded by thorny hedges. "None of them are alike," she said. "Your brother had part of the truth," Ser Jorah admitted. "The Dothraki do not build. 1,000 years ago, to make a house, they would dig a hole in the earth and cover it with a woven grass roof. The buildings, you see, were made by slaves brought here from lands they've plundered, and they built each after the fashion of their own peoples." Most of the halls, even the largest, seemed deserted. "Where are the people who live here?" Danny asked. The bazaar had been full of running children and men shouting, but elsewhere she had seen only a few eunuchs going about their business. "Only the crones of the Dushkaleen dwell permanently in the sacred city, them and their slaves and servants," Ser Jorah replied. "Yet Vaes Dothrak is large enough to house every man of every Khalasar, should all the Khals return to the mother at once. The crones have prophesied that one day that will come to pass, so Vaes Dothrak must be ready to embrace all its children." Khal Drogo finally called a halt near the Eastern Market, where the caravans from Yi Ti and Ashayi and the Shadowlands came to trade, with the Mother of Mountains looming overhead. Danny smiled as she recalled Magister Illyrio's slave girl and her talk of a palace with 200 rooms and doors of solid silver. The palace was a cavernous wooden feasting hall, its rough-hewn timbered walls rising 40 feet, its roof sewn silk, a vast billowing tent that could be raised to keep out the rare rains or lowered to admit the endless sky. Around the hall were broad, grassy horse yards, fenced with high hedges, fire pits, and hundreds of round earthen houses that bulged from the ground like miniature hills covered with grass. A small army of slaves had gone ahead to prepare for Khal Drogo's arrival. As each rider swung down from his saddle, he unbelted his arak and handed it to a waiting slave, and any other weapon he carried as well. Even Khal Drogo himself was not exempt. Ser Jorah had explained that it was forbidden to carry a blade in Vaes Dothrak or to shed a free man's blood. Even warring Khalasars put aside their feuds and shared meat and mead together when they were in sight of the Mother of Mountains. In this place, the crones of the Dushkaleen had decreed all Dothraki were one blood, one Khalasar, one herd.
Kahalo came to Danny as Iri and Jiqui were helping her down off her silver. He was the oldest of Drogo's three blood riders, a squat, bald man with a crooked nose and a mouth full of broken teeth, shattered by a mace 20 years before when he saved the young Kalakar from sellswords who hoped to sell him to his father's enemies. His life had been bound to Drogo's the day her lord husband was born. Every Karl had his blood riders. At first Danny had thought of them as a kind of Dothraki Kingsguard, sworn to protect their lord. But it went further than that. Jiqui had taught her that a blood rider was more than a guard. They were the Karl's brothers, his shadows, his fiercest friends. Blood of my blood, Drogo called them, and so it was. They shared a single life. The ancient traditions of the horse lords demanded that when the Karl died, his blood riders died with him, to ride at his side in the Nightlands. If the Karl died at the hands of some enemy, they lived only long enough to avenge him, and then followed him joyfully into the grave. In some Kalasars, Jiqui said, the blood riders shared the Karl's wine, his tent, and even his wives, though never his horses. A man's mount was his own. Daenerys was glad that Karl Drogo did not hold to those ancient ways. She should not have liked being shared. And while old Kahalo treated her kindly enough, the others frightened her. Hago, huge and silent, often glowered as if he had forgotten who she was, and Cutho had cruel eyes and quick hands that liked to hurt. He left bruises on Daria's soft white skin whenever he touched her, and sometimes made Iris sob in the night. Even his horses seemed to fear him. Yet they were bound to Drogo for life and death, so Daenerys had no choice but to accept them. And sometimes she found herself wishing her father had been protected by such men. In the songs, the white knights of the Kingsguard were ever noble, valiant and true. And yet, King Aerys had been murdered by one of them, the handsome boy they now called the Kingslayer, and a second, Sir Barristan the Bold, had gone over to the Usurper. She wondered if all men were as false in the Seven Kingdoms. When her son sat the Iron Throne, she would see that he had blood riders of his own to protect him against treachery in his king's guard.
Khaleesi,
Kahalo said to her in Dothraki, Drogo, who is blood of my blood, commands me to tell you that he must ascend the Mother of Mountains this night to sacrifice to the gods for his safe return. Only men were allowed to set foot on the Mother, Danny knew. The Karl's blood riders would go with him and return at dawn. Tell my sun and stars that I dream of him and wait anxious for his return, she replied, thankful. Danny tired more easily as the child grew within her. In truth, a night of rest would be most welcome. Her pregnancy only seemed to have inflamed Drogo's desire for her, and of late his embraces left her exhausted. Doria led her to the hollow hill that had been prepared for her and her Karl. It was cool and dim within, like a tent made of earth. Jiqui, a bath, please, she commanded, to wash the dust of travel from her skin and soak her weary bones. It was pleasant to know they would linger here for a while, that she would not need to climb back on her silver on the morrow. The water was scalding hot, as she liked it. I will give my brother his gifts tonight, she decided as Jiqui was washing her hair. He should look a king in the sacred city. Doria, run and find him and invite him to sup with me. Viserys was nicer to the Lycene girl than to her Dothraki handmaids, perhaps because Magister Illyrio had let him bet her back in Pentos. Iri, go to the bazaar and buy fruit and meat, anything but horse flesh. Horse is best, Iri said. Horse makes man strong. Viserys hates horse meat. As you say, Khaleesi. She brought back a haunch of goat and a basket of fruits and vegetables. Jiqui roasted the meat with sweet grass and fire pods, basting it with honey as it cooked.
and there were melons and pomegranates and plums and some queer eastern fruit Danny did not know. While her handmaids prepared the meal, Danny laid out the clothing she had had made to her brother's measure, a tunic and leggings of crisp